Take your nose.
Perfect timing. Perfect timing. There we go. There we go. Well, thank you guys very much. Thanks. I hope everyone can hear us okay. I'll do my best to keep the microphone fairly close. As we open up the initial budget hearings for the 2022-2023 biennium, which is going to be a little bit different, I think, as a lot of folks can understand. I want to do a couple things. First, I want to thank everyone for joining us here, both in person. We're doing this out of the Department of Transportation, I think in a safe and socially distanced way, and I appreciate everyone for making kind of the changes, if you will, to adjust. We know we can't fill the room like we normally do over at the LOB, but we are having obviously a lot of folks join us telephonically today as well, which is good. In some ways, you can actually get higher participation by making sure that more people, I think, as we're using technology to be part of the process. And I think that's one of the best things you can do in the budget process is you get that stakeholder input. Folks understand where we're starting from, what that kind of that ground game is, that kind of builds into what the agencies are looking for, what some of their priorities are, that builds into the governor's budget, and then ultimately the legislature has at it, as they say, and both the House and the Senate side. I want to thank both Representative Ken Weiler and Lynn Over for joining us from the House of Representatives. I believe Chuck Morse, he's joining us telephonically, and some folks from the State Senate as well. I also want to recognize Max Dellum, my budget director, and Matt Melo. Max has been my budget director on and off, so to say, for the last few years, done a phenomenal job through the initial budget, which really was led by Charlie Arlinghouse, taking the reins on that. I'm sorry, Commissioner Arlinghouse over there. Taking the reins on that and then driving into the last budget session, which really required a lot of work and a lot of digging deep, working with both Republicans and Democrats and finding that compromise. And it worked. It really did. It worked very well. Max will be moving on shortly, although we will have a cell number and have him on a short lease, to be sure. And Matt Melo will be taking over a little bit, a lot of it actually, as our budget director, as we continue to build up the team out of the governor's office. And we're already kind of in that transition. These Matt are working kind of hand in hand and have been for the past couple months. Matt comes over from the Office of Strategic Initiatives and most recently Gopher, which has been managing and distributing the $1.25 billion in CARES Act funds. So they've been working very closely with a lot of the different departments already, which is great. But I also want to take a moment and also just thank all the departments. I know this has been very trying. COVID started, major economic crisis comes upon the state, and we brought all the departments together, and everybody really did a phenomenal job. And I really do mean that. We put some of the toughest management restrictions and constraints, if you will, in history on some of the departments, asked everyone to dig deep. Didn't mean we were wholesaling, slashing, and cutting programs, but just finding efficiencies, finding where some of those general fund dollars could be saved, especially in the earlier months of this crisis, because no one really had any idea. It was unlike anything we had ever seen. We didn't know how long it was going to last. We didn't know what the true economic and business effects were going to be. And even now, as we're coming out of it and have continued to climb out of that the very economically tough time, I think we're seeing good numbers, and we can talk about that a little bit. But we're still trying to get an understanding of not just where we are today. I think we have a good sense of today, but where this is really going to go. Nothing like this has ever happened. So while we're on a very positive track, you still want to be careful about where your predictions are taking you and not get too overly optimistic or too conservative, frankly. I always say that, it's one thing to be very liberal in numbers or very conservative in numbers, but the best thing to do is be right with your numbers, right? To really use the data and the predictive analytics that you have to be as accurate as possible, not just as tight as possible, but as accurate as possible, because that just makes everyone's life a lot easier, a lot smoother. It allows for the right programs to be funded the appropriate way. Folks can plan and predict where their departments are truly going to go. It's nice to have money left over, of course. That's always a great thing, but that should really only come if again, we were working 110% to get it absolutely right, and things turned out actually better than we could have predicted. And that can be a very good thing, but getting it spot on the nose is really the goal. Very, very hard thing to do when you're dealing with a $12 to $13 billion budget combining both federal funds and general funds. I also want to bring talk a little bit, if we may, where we are today. And one of the reasons we're going to start with the Department of Revenue Administration, which, again, we don't typically start with DRA, but it's been such an important piece, and Commissioner Steph has done a phenomenal job with 13, not just at the state level in terms of figuring out where we are, how to work with businesses. The effort that they have done through the Gopher process has been incredible, working hand in glove with Gopher to set up a lot of the funds and distribution mechanisms that we have. We've tied a lot of that into DRA so that we can have an auditing and accountability aspect to it, knowing that also they also have a very big job to do in terms of collecting taxes and understanding what those tax revenues coming into the state might be. These numbers in terms of where we are today and where we go tomorrow are going to be so critical to understanding and having, like I said, the most spot-on budget that we can. The good news is this, and I don't, you know, we don't want to see any state have to go through tough economic times. That's not good for the country. And in a place like New Hampshire, it's really not good for New Hampshire when Vermont or Maine or Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, you want to see all those states doing very, very well, because we are truly all in this together when it comes to the economy. So many folks travel across state lines for business. But unfortunately, there are a lot of states in the Northeast that are going to go through some very, very tough economic time, not just with the private business side, but the direct and indirect effect that will have on their revenue streams within state government. You have a state like New Jersey that has recently announced they're going to bond $4 billion just in general obligation, general fund. That's crazy. That's really just really out there. And obviously, you know, we ain't going there, and we don't have those kind of problems. Even the state of Massachusetts is going to have a lot of very deep-rooted economic tough times, and they were at the tip of the spear with COVID. They had to make some incredibly tough decisions, and I don't envy Governor Baker's job at all. I think he's done a phenomenal job down there, but they're going to have some tough economic times. What our agencies were able to do in combination with Gopher, and as we brought the economy back in, I think, a very sound, balanced, strong way, keeping COVID numbers low while we could, keeping the economy strong, and the discipline that our agencies have exhibited to date, and the discipline we're going to ask them to keep through the end of the biennium, through the end of June of 21, that creates opportunity for this next budget, right? That hard discipline today doesn't stop, it continues, but it actually creates a lot more flexibility and a lot more opportunity in the budget to come. And so, you know, we don't know what's going to come out of the federal government. Will there be stimulus? Will there be revenue enhancement? Will there be this? Well, we don't know. I assume there will be. I think a lot of people assume that something is likely going to get done, not anytime soon, probably in early 2021. But we really don't know what it is. We can't count on it. We don't know what it will look like. We don't know what federal streams will be attached to it. We don't know if we'll be able to assist with city and town revenue or whatever it might be. So I'm a firm believer we have to build a budget assuming we're on we're handling our business in the state of New Hampshire as we always do for the state of New Hampshire and with the revenue streams that we have. Anything else beyond that is great. The good news is this, while other states will likely have to use any additional federal stimulus revenue, a lot of that, the billions that other states might get to backfill their revenue streams, we'll be able to use a lot of that revenue to drive forward on the economy, on business, on infrastructure, where it really needs to go, and where you can actually have a long-term compounded beneficial impact to the state. When the economy does well, when you're creating jobs, the state does well. That model has been proven out. When you cut taxes, the state does well, business does well, and actually, you know, you get better revenue in here. We have businesses coming in all over the country right now. All over the country, they are climbing over themselves to come into New Hampshire. That's really great. The model that we created in 2017 and 2018 is disciplined. We've held to it. It's working very well. We want to stay on that model. But again, this is a long way of saying a big thank you to all the departments for staying disciplined, for all the businesses, in terms of what we're able to do with all the, I think of the $1.25 billion, I think we estimated close to $500 to $600 million just in economic stimulus out to the businesses and the private sector and the self-employed and the nonprofits and all of that. That's really allowing them to pay their taxes And again, in turn, it helps the city and town. Remember, what we do at the state level does have an impact in terms of city and town, with everything from programming opportunities that we create, but also the economic flexibility, helping them set the tax rates and all of that, those sorts of things, keeping them balanced and stable. And right now they look fairly stable. We don't know where the December numbers will come in for a lot of the local property tax revenue, but we're constantly looking at that. I know James Jerry and his team are working very hard on all of the tax rates, which have been coming out, and I think there's still a few to come out. But so far things are looking very, very good compared to what we thought they were going to be in May. And frankly, just they continue on a very positive path. There's still the last thing I'm going to throw out here, and I apologize for going on for so long, but these are very interesting times, and I just want folks to understand, out of our office, the governor's office, some of the disciplines that we're going to be looking at. I still think there are some real changes that we could make structurally here in New Hampshire to create better long-term balance sheet management for the state. I personally believe, and again, this is something we'll bring up later in our budget, I think that our rainy day fund needs to be doubled or tripled, because if anything, COVID showed when it rains, it pours, and you got to be prepared. Luckily, I think that the money we have in there right now, because of good other fiscal management, we'll be able to handle if we need to down the road what we might need to make sure that we keep everything balanced for this biennium. But again, having caps on saving accounts, having limits on saving accounts makes no sense at all. The state needs to save, and because that just creates opportunity for everyone. We started to look at things in terms of the credit that businesses have, the amount of credit that businesses can use, their kind of built up credit. There's hundreds of millions of dollars, to my understanding, of potential credit that businesses could be using, which could create a real cash flow issue for the state. So even though businesses are doing well and they're paying the taxes, so we have to look at structurally how that works. And again, anything we can do to manage those liabilities in the long term, just so we're setting ourselves up for success. Anytime you can take liability off the balance sheet, that's a good thing. Anytime you can put more money in your savings account, that's even a better thing. So those types of fundamentals we talk about, but I always think that we can do better, and now is the time to do it, because we have such it's going to be a very different looking budget. I think we're asking all the departments across the board, all the departments, to dig deep. They've done a great job in the short term, but look for those long-term innovative efficiencies within their department. It isn't just about cutting staff here and cutting a program there, but is there a smarter way to do it, a better way to use technology, a better way for customer interface, as I like to say. I was talking to Director Balecki over at the DMV just this morning about some of the innovative things that they're doing in terms of everything from updating your license online, some of the flexibilities we've provided in doing more things that remotely, as opposed to just doing everything in person the old-fashioned way. People want to use technology. It can be done faster. It can be done cheaper. It's out there, so let's use it, right? Let's be innovative, and sometimes that means spending a little extra on capital today to save a lot of the dollars in long-term obligations and costs down the road. So those are the types of things I think the departments have already shown. They're doing very, very well here in New Hampshire. The last two things I'm going to add here, I know that yesterday the state updated the credit rating agency. We were on a call with the credit rating agency, updating with them on our finances, the state's efforts to contain costs, and just help close those gaps between the appropriations and revenues, and all that was noted. And I'm not sure what the next step is on the credit rate, but on the credit rate, I'll look the map a little bit, but the next step would be there.
We're waiting for a formal notification, but the preliminary feedback from the agencies is very complimentary. Usually they don't tell us we're doing all the things they would hope we were doing, so it was great to hear.
Oh, that's great. That's terrific. And I mean, again, we don't wish ill will on any other state, but I can guarantee you a lot of other states were not hearing that yesterday, unfortunately. A lot of states with the credit agencies because of the tough economic times that so much of the country is going to go through. New Hampshire will come out of this crisis well positioned. I have full confidence in that because of what we've seen already. We know what we can do, what we have done, so there's no reason to think that assuming we don't, not something out of the blue doesn't come. I think we really are on a very positive track. Our economic fundamentals, as we discussed, both with the credit agencies, and I think as we're that builds the basis for a lot of these budget hearings that we're going to be having over the next couple of days, they are strong. And again, we've always talked about not raising taxes, but lowering taxes, having government be more efficient, providing those critical needs, those critical services. whatever we have to do to get people the help they need and then perhaps get the heck out of their way. That's what New Hampshire should be doing. I think that's what we can do, and when we do it better than anybody else. And when you do that, it just creates so much more freedom and economic stability and opportunity for those individuals, those citizens, those businesses, those families, whatever it might be. So we feel very positive, to be sure. A lot of work to do. This is going to be a tough budget, without a doubt. But again, just to back up a little bit, a big thank you to our first budget presenters, Commissioner Stepp and her team at the DRA. You guys just cannot thank you enough. You've knocked it out of the park. I know there were a lot of long nights, a lot of long nights, a lot of endless weekends, or non-existent weekends, frankly. For many, many months, for many individuals at DRA, the weekends just did not exist as everything kind of clamped down and the State House got kind of quiet. It was our team and the governor's team at the State House for many months, and Lindsay on the phone five times a day and her team and the folks at HHS just working around the clock. But that hard work has really paid off, and we're already seeing the results. So with that, we can open things up, and I'll turn it over to you, Commissioner.
Great. Thank you, Governor. Good morning. For the record, Lindsay Stepp, Commissioner at the New Hampshire Department of Revenue Administration. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present our fiscal year 2022 and 2023 operating budget requests from the DRA. With me today is Carolyn Lear, Assistant Commissioner at the DRA, and Shelley Berlano, our Business Administrator. On the phone, we also have Division Directors Fred Coolbrock, Deb Borbeau, Oral Lemire, James Gary, and our IT lead, Karen Sampson. The mission of the DRA is to fairly and efficiently administer the tax laws of the state of New Hampshire, collecting the proper amount of taxes due, incurring the least cost to taxpayers in a manner that merits the highest degree of public confidence in our integrity. Further, we provide prompt and constructive assistance to the municipal units of government in matters of budget, finance, and the appraisal of real estate. Together, we developed a thoughtful operating budget that will provide the resources for our team to administer the tax laws of our state for another two fiscal years in a manner that is consistent with this mission. As the primary revenue collection agency, you're certainly aware of the current revenue picture and have worked hard to produce a budget that is consistent with the targets that have been provided. In fiscal year 2020, the DRA collected $2.2 billion in state revenue, with total expenses of less than $19.4 million. Some of those expenses were for activities that are unrelated to revenue collection, such as local assessment reviews and state aid. When those costs are accounted for, our cost of collection is approximately 0.75%. The slides included with this testimony explain how we were able to build a biennial budget that continues to be an unparalleled return on state dollar investment. We look forward to working with you, Governor, and the legislature as you build the next two-year operating budget. Moving on to the slide presentation, we can actually move to slide three. This is a high-level overview of the DRA. We have the administration unit, which includes the commissioner's office, our legal and tax policy, back office functions such as the business office and HR, as well as project management. Our audit division includes an in-state bureau, a multi-entity bureau, a multi-state bureau, discovery unit, and tobacco unit. Our collections unit, or collections division, does exactly what it says. They collect unpaid taxes. Taxpayer services division, this includes document processing, our call center, and routine maintenance. You're not under audit, and we're not in a collection situation. Your primary point of contact is going to be our taxpayer services division. And last but not least, our municipal and property division. As the governor mentioned, those folks are responsible for setting the tax rates for all the municipalities within the state. They oversee property appraisal. They assess utility property tax, and they also help the municipalities administer sticks and stones, the gravel and timber tax. On to slide four, this is just the big picture of what our 2023 agency budget looks like. Our total funds budget in fiscal year 20, adjusted authorized, was $22.6 million. Our fiscal year 20 actual spend was $19.3 million. It's about a 14.6% reduction from adjusted authorized. When COVID hit and the revenues started to look less than promising. We very quickly tightened our spending and achieved some pretty good last results there. Our fiscal year 21 adjusted authorized budget is currently $22.9 million. For fiscal year 22, our efficiency budget is $19.9 million. That's a 12.8% reduction from fiscal year 21. And our fiscal year 23 efficiency budget request is $20.7 million, which is 9.6% reduction from fiscal year 21. These both fiscal year 22 and 23 are consistent with the budget targets that were provided by the governor's office. Our budget is approximately 90% general funds. The remaining 10% of our budget is made up of education trust funds, money for the low and moderate property tax relief, and we have other funds for flood control, and I'll talk about those in greater detail as we move forward. On to slide five, fiscal year 22-23 agency budget highlights. Our current position count today is 157 full-time classified and unclassified positions, and we will be decreasing that in our request to 147 positions in fiscal years 22 and 23. Our general fund operating budget is 75% salary and benefits. We're a department of people, not things or programs. So when we do see reductions, they primarily need to come from salaries and benefits. All of the positions that we have proposed to unfund, those 10 positions, are currently vacant. Our DYT services and positions are clean within our proposed budget. Our DOIT efficiency budget costs are steady over the biennium, but are reduced by approximately 9.8% compared to where they are currently in fiscal year 21. Funding for some critical vendors, such as our equalization and tax rate setting vendor, are included in our efficiency budget. However, other vendors, such as temporary cleaning services, are included as prioritized needs. Our budget maintains operational capabilities as we anticipate adjusting resources for our Revenue Information Management System, or RIM, project. However, we did eliminate consulting services that were included in our last operating budget for RIM. However, we do have additional funds and capital that we can use to still maintain those services. Other reductions in our budget include out-of-state travel, employee training, and overtime. While reductions can be achieved in these areas, some amounts were included as prioritized needs in order to maintain quality audits, quality employees, and the quality customer service that DRB strives for. The division directors, the business office, and other managers work very hard to budget conservatively and accurately, and we are trying to request funds for needs and not wants. Moving to slide six, I'll start going through our prioritized needs. As I mentioned, DRE's efficiency budget as submitted maintains all current operations. However, there are certain areas where DRA has requested additional funding in the form of prioritized needs. The first is within the area of auditing for compliance. We're requesting funding for three positions in the audit division and increasing funding for out-of-state travel. These three positions include a tobacco auditor, an in-state auditor, and a multi-entity auditor. The out-of-state travel that's being requested will support our multi-state audit bureau as they eventually get back out on the road and start performing some more in-person audits. On to slide seven, our second prioritized need is in the area of taxpayer services for timely processing and maintaining customer service. We are requesting funding for three positions in the Taxpayer Services Division. This includes the Assistant Director position and two Tax Examiner positions, and funding for temporary keying services and increasing employee training. The additional positions in temporary keying services contracts help to ensure the timely processing of documents. Obviously, we have busy seasons throughout the year, March and April. October and November are two examples. And then the training that we're requesting will be focused on customer service for the call center and taxpayer assistance employees. We routinely get very high marks for our call center employees. There is a survey that is available to callers at the end of the call, and I get reports every week of everyone that's filled out that survey, and we routinely score very high on both our knowledge and professionalism and also just the friendliness of the folks in our call center. 5-8, our third priority is collections and audit staffing, again, for increased compliance. We are looking for funding for 2 positions in the audit division and 1 position in the collections division. The positions in the audit division would include in-state and multi-state auditors, and the additional collection position is responsible for the more complex compliance actions and overseeing our compliance officers. It's more of a supervisory position within our collections division. Lastly, our fourth priority is from DOIT and DAS, and these are shared services costs that are passed on to DRA for continued operations. So these are requests of those two agencies, which we included as our fourth priority. Moving on to 5-9. As I mentioned, DRA's additional prioritized needs were carefully selected, and we are not just looking to restore funding to fiscal year 21 levels. We took the direction from the governor's office seriously. Again, our fiscal year 21 adjusted authorized is $22.9 million. Our fiscal year 22 efficiency is the 19.9. If you add in our three prioritized needs, our fiscal year 22 would be $20.9 million, which is still a reduction of almost 9% from fiscal year 21. Again, in fiscal year 23, if you add in the prioritized needs, you arrive at $21.7 million, which is a 5.3% reduction from fiscal year 21. So again, we really feel like these are priority needs, and we're not just looking to restore fiscal year 21 levels. Moving on to slide 10, I mentioned at the beginning, flood control. Flood control is part of our other fund. In total, it's $887,000, about $256,000 from general fund and $630,000 from other funds for fiscal year 22. The purpose of flood control is the department reimburses cities and towns for lost property taxes resulting from property that's been acquired in the acquisition of land by the United States for navigation and flood control. This is the Connecticut River and the Merrimack River. The fiscal year 22 and 23 budget assumes that Massachusetts will reimburse their share of 70% of the Merrimack River Valley Compact, as well as 50% of the Connecticut River Valley Compact. And the state of Connecticut will reimburse their share of 40% of the Connecticut However, there's long history of Massachusetts not paying its obligation timely or sufficiently for the Merrimack River Valley Compact. There is currently almost $3 million outstanding in payments from Massachusetts for fiscal years 15 through fiscal years 20. Amounts for fiscal year 14 and prior have already been settled.
Can we, Mr. Attorney General, can we add that to the Supreme Court? can we put a footnote in there to get the other $3 million back? Just make a note of it.
To follow up on the governor's question, I believe we're about to enter arbitration. Is that correct, Mr. Attorney General?
I believe that's correct. Yes, the Attorney General's office has been working very hard on trying to get this money.
Do you know what the timing of that is, that arbitration?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay.
The governor is authorized to draw warrants for the payment of the reimbursement of money in the Treasury that's not otherwise appropriated. So the cities and towns are made whole regardless of whether or not Massachusetts and Connecticut pays us. So the federal warrant that will be necessary for fiscal year 21 is about $616,000. Moving on to slide 11. Low and moderate property tax relief. This is included in our budget as education trust funds. An education trust fund appropriation. This is property tax relief related to the statewide education property tax. We have requested amounts of $800,000 in both fiscal years 22 and 23, and our request reflects a decline in total program costs over the past few years. You'll see in fiscal year 20, the amounts were just over $700,000. So we have tried to right-size this appropriation in our budget.
So can I ask a quick question? I don't mean to pause, to stop you right there. So are you saying from fiscal year 18 to fiscal year 20, you dropped that 40%?
Yeah, that's the amount that's actually been paid out. And one of the reasons is the amount to qualify for this program have not changed in a number of years. So a lot of people are kind of earning out of this program. So
Is that a change that we should look to make?
There have been conversations within the legislature to potentially adjust this, and I believe the School Funding Commission is currently looking into this as well.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Nope.
Thank you.
Lastly, I just wanted to provide an update on fiscal year 20 and 21 budget priorities. First, a quick update on our RIM system. DRA received a $30,160,000 capital appropriation from general water funds to replace our old TIM system. We entered into a contract with Fast Enterprises to implement its commercial office shelf software GenCast. And the cost of that contract was $29,550,000. The implementation will consist of three rollouts. We went live with the first rollout on October 28, 2019, with our meals and rentals tax, Medicaid enhancement tax, and nursing facility quality assessment. We went live on time as planned with rollout two on October 5th, 2020. We did not experience any delays as we shifted to fully remote work on this project during the pandemic. And that included the business profit tax, business enterprise tax, interest and dividends tax, and communication services tax. So really our largest rollout, we're very proud of the work that happened there. The third and final rollout is scheduled to go live on August 9th of 2021 with the real estate transfer tax, tobacco tax, utility property tax, gravel tax, timber tax, railroad, and private car taxes. As I mentioned, rollout one and rollout two were very successful, and we anticipate a similar outcome for rollout three. Our current contract includes 4 years of support and maintenance on the system after rollout three with optional extensions. So our vendor isn't going anywhere. We fully anticipate the project to continue moving very smoothly over the next few years. And like I said, we're really proud of the work. It's received great feedback from businesses and taxpayers that have used the system, and we're happy to finally have a modern tax system here in New Hampshire. As I mentioned, the RIN health assessment is the consulting services that we have requested and have been provided. In the last budget, we did include a prioritized need for $340,000 to assist the DRA with these services. We were able to include that amount within our capital budget, so we have not funded this amount in 22 and 23. I'm happy to report that the vendor, Mary Dunn, has completed 6 project health assessments so far, and they have all of the health assessments gave the project an overall score of 5 or outstanding with no actions or changes recommended. So it's nice to have that second opinion on how the project's going. We feel like it's been very successful, but it's nice to have an independent view as well. And they have been very impressed with our work on that project. Lastly, just wanted to touch on staffing briefly because the 2020-2021 budget included additional positions in the audit division for DRA. We had an in-state and multi-entity auditor funded for both years of the biennium. We had 2 multi-state auditors that were funded for half of fiscal year 20 and all of 21. And then we had a multi-state auditor position funded in fiscal year 21. All of these positions are currently unfilled. Given the delay in passing the budget, the timing of getting positions posted, and then the pandemic and subsequent hiring freeze, all of these positions remain unfilled. However, we did include the in-state auditor, the multi-entity auditor, and one of the multi-state auditor positions in our prioritized needs for 22 and 23. That concludes my prepared presentation, but I'm happy to answer any additional questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Commissioner. And a great job, and it's great to see the fact that you were able to keep the phase 2 of the RIM system rolling out on October 5th, this past October, is just incredible. I guess the only thing I'll ask, and then I'll see if anyone else wants to ask questions, we're open for it. Two questions. Just the idea that on the prioritized needs, when we're talking about putting some of these auditing positions back in, there's a couple different auditors effectively raise more money, right? They effectively pay for themselves, is my understanding. And I think, just to reiterate what I think I'm hearing, is that by funding these positions, we actually create better efficiencies and we get a positive return on that investment.
That is 100% correct. I should note, and I should have mentioned this earlier, within the audit division, we have, as I mentioned, the in-state bureau, the multi-entity bureau, and the multi-state bureau. In-state is exactly what it is. It is smaller in-state New Hampshire businesses, multi-entity. Those folks deal with more of your regional businesses, maybe like a New England business or something of that size. And then multi-entity, those are the auditors that go out to the very large multinational corporations and do auditing there. So obviously the return on investment in those positions increased with the complexity, in-state having the smallest return on investment, but having the shortest learning curve. So we're able to bring those auditors on pretty quickly and have them producing and producing revenue in a much faster time than, say, the more complex multi-state auditor who over the long run is going to generate more revenue, but the time for the learning curve is a little bit longer. So we have prioritized the in-state and multi-entity positions in the first priority with multi-state positions later. But yes, Governor, you're 100% correct. We always have revenue attached to those new positions.
That's great. I'm a big believer. You cut taxes, but those that have to pay, you got to collect, and you got to get that efficiency up as high as you can. It's really only fair. The last question I'll have, and then I'll open it up. On the RIM system, I noticed it looks. Just to be clear, you're looking to take out the consulting services, correct?
Correct.
That won't have an impact in terms of getting the next phase up, I assume.
It will not. So as I said, those consulting services have been those health assessments, the six that we've had prepared to date. Before the money was in the operating budget, we have been paying for that out of our capital budget. And given some strong, I think, management of that contract, we have some excess in the capital budget to pay for the remaining health assessments. So we don't need to fund it any longer out of the operating budget. The funding is sufficient that we have in the capital budget.
Great. Any other questions? Lynn, Representative Boker.
Thank you, Governor. Commissioner, thank you. Thank you for the great job. I'd like to think you had on what the Governor asked you in his first question. I'm well aware in finance that when we add your priority positions, we get more revenue. What I'd ask you to do is when you work with ways and means on revenue estimates, to make that very clear to them, because what happens is ways and means brings revenue estimates to the floor of the House. The House votes on it. That's the budget that finance is trying to meet because we're not allowed to borrow money. We have in the past when Commissioner Beardmore was Commissioner, gone back to ways and means and said, please raise your revenue estimates, we want to add these. If you could start that with them so they would be thinking that would really be great by the time we get to finance. I appreciate it.
Sure, we would be more than happy to do that. As I mentioned, we have specific revenue amounts that we anticipate for the various positions, so that's a very easy thing to do, and we will start saying that.
Great.
Commissioner, just one quick question. As part of the capital funding for the RIMS project, there was a portion of the bond that was floated that was issued from enhanced revenue from efficiencies. Where is that escrow account? If it's not, doesn't live in the operating budget, does it?
It does not. That is a separate account of what we call the revenue uplift account. We have not yet deposited any funds into that. It was anticipated, or we were hopeful that fiscal year 20 would be the first year that we could deposit into that account. We can deposit up to $4 million in revenue uplift in a year. However, given how fiscal year 20 ended, there was no revenue uplift, but I fully anticipate fiscal year 21 going forward, we will have revenue uplift. It will be deposited into that account, and we will make deposits into that account until we reach $40 million. And we will be reporting to the legislature how that revenue uplift is determined and the amount that we deposit in each year.
That's just something I think we'll have to work and have it set up so the debt services are correctly accounted for.
I believe the account is set up. I believe there's just nothing in it at the moment. But we have worked with Treasury and with Michelle, our business administrator.
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
Mary Jane, do you have their own phone?
They were not on the polls.
Okay. And I would just ask, I don't know if Senator Moore, Senator D'Alessandro, or even Mary Jane Wallner, I don't know if any of them are joining us on the phone, but of course, if they are and would like to ask any questions, now's the time.
Someone, they can raise their hand.
Oh, they can raise their hand by pressing 5-star. Is that right? 5-star. I'm getting good at this one. We'll just give them a moment. Everyone can bear with us. Okay. Well, seeing none, Commissioner, thank you guys very much, and I really appreciate the presentation. Terrific job, good luck.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch. Oh, sorry. Hold on.
there's a question from Marshall Island.
Oh, Senator Morse is with us. Great. Senator, can you hear us okay?
Yes, thanks, Governor. And thanks for everything everyone's doing. I just had a question on revenues in general from, like, payroll protection money and everything else that's come into the state, especially on the side on businesses. Is this going to be a pickup that's considered revenue in the state of New Hampshire, and it's going to be taxed that way?
Sure, Senator, that's a great question. There's actually a press release on the department's website that talks through the taxability of both state and federal aid for businesses. When you're talking about PPP specifically, as we know, if that money is, that loan is forgiven, it becomes a grant at the federal level and it is not taxable, and the related expenses are not deductible federally. In New Hampshire, because we do not conform to the current Internal Revenue Code, PPP, forgivable PPP loans will be taxable, will be included in income, but the businesses are able, to the extent that those expenses are deductible, they can deduct them. And again, there is guidance or a press release on our website that helps walk businesses through that, and certainly they can always call the DRA if there are questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Good to hear from you. And what we'll do after each presentation, we'll just check in with anyone, with either Senator Del Sandler, Mayor Jane, or Chuck, Senator Morse, make sure that they're part of the process. It's going to be quite important that they're part of the process going forward. So thank you guys very much. I appreciate Commissioner Stepp. And now we'll bring up the Attorney General and the Department of Justice for their presentation.
Morning, Governor.
Good morning, Mr. Attorney General. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
With me is our Director of Administration, Kathy Clark. We have prepared some slides, and if the committee would like, I'd like to run through them.
Jump right in.
Okay. Let's go to the slide. Unfortunately, they're not numbered, so please be patient. The first slide is the many roles of the Attorney General, and it's just to give you some context of what we do in our office. The Attorney General has existed, the office has existed in our state since 1683, predates our Constitution by 100 years. Common law powers that existed before the enactment of our Constitution have been brought forward and augmented by statute over the years. The Attorney General in our state has very broad and important powers and very broad jurisdiction relative to other states. Attorneys General. There are five distinct roles. Number one, the Attorney General serves as the Chief Law Enforcement Officer for our state, supervisory responsibility for 5,000 sworn law enforcement officers. Second, the Attorney General serves as the Chief Prosecutor of our state. We have plenary jurisdiction over all misdemeanor and felony prosecutions. Most of those are prosecuted by county attorneys. Our office prosecutes major crimes, including homicides. Three, we serve as the chief legal officer for the state of New Hampshire, a $13 billion enterprise, thousands of employees across an incredible spectrum of functions. If the state is sued, we defend the state. We give advice to executive branch agencies, and when the state brings action, we represent the state of New Hampshire. Fourth, the Attorney General has the responsibility to protect the public in areas such as consumer protection, environmental protection, charities regulation. And finally, the Attorney General serves as the equivalent of a commissioner of an executive department. Our department, of course, is the Department of Justice. We have two divisions, 157 employees, full-time employees. We cover an incredibly broad range of expertise and function. Next page is intended to convey some examples of the value that we confer and the services we perform for the people of New Hampshire. $8.3 million recovered, deposited into the general fund. Regularly, thousands of charities. Our medical examiner performed vital investigative functions. We had very direct facing functions in consumer protection and charities regulation. And we also managed more than $40 million over the biennium in court and federal grants. The next slide is titled COVID-19 Emergency Response Efforts. And I never envisioned when I took this office being faced with the challenges that we have all faced collectively. And I want to say how proud I am of our team to join the largest state team in providing support to the governor and to our client agencies as we've navigated and continue to navigate this public health crisis. We have, in real time, had to convert functions of state government into the realities of the public health emergency and pandemic we face. Next, I'd like to just give a brief overview of our efficiency budget. We were challenged to meet the goals that the governor set, and we've met the challenge. We believe in our efficiency budget. We can continue to discharge the important functions we have for the people of our state within the constraints of the governor's set forth. The efficiency budget overview is really just to give you a sense. We are 32% generally funded, 68% other funds. The majority of other funds are federal grants. Grants from the U.S. Department of Justice, primarily in the area of victim assistance and law enforcement, flow through our agency, and almost all of them are subgranted out to agencies which serve our public. The next two slides are really just pie charts breaking down our efficiency budget funding and our priority needs fund. I do want to speak to our prioritized needs. Go to this slide with the three boxes. Just to summarize, we are asking for three new attorney positions and then to fill two existing but unfunded investigator positions. The next slide talks about the need for these priority positions. Number one, to implement our piece of the LEAC recommendations. Governor, you approved all 48 LEAC proposals. One of them was for our office to create a public integrity unit, long overdue in my opinion. And to do that, we are asking for one new additional attorney and the ability to, one new additional attorney position and the ability to fill an investigator position that is currently open. And let me just pause there. This function of the office is going to take on and assume a very important investigation that we have ongoing now with respect to events, historic events at the Youth Development Center. This is by far the largest investigation in the modern history of our state. Through the cooperation of Colonel Noyes and Commissioner Quinn, we have 10 state troopers assigned to that investigation. And we need additional attorney support to bring justice to the victims in this crime. In addition to that, we will be discharging the public integrity function of the LEAC Commission.
And if I may, where is that, what division is handling the investigation now?
It's our criminal justice.
It's within criminal justice.
Yep. Number two, our office, the Consumer Protection and Antitrust Bureau, is facing a unprecedented challenge in reviewing three major transactions involving our acute care hospitals. The one between Exeter and Wentworth Douglas, number two, Dartmouth-Hitchcock, and Granite One, which is the healthcare group led by CNC, and three, the LRGH transaction, which is in the bankruptcy. Altogether, 12 of our 26 acute care hospitals are involved one way or another in these mergers. And we need an additional antitrust attorney to help us manage and investigate those mergers. And then finally, we have an open position that has been authorized in our election law unit, really important function that our office serves in terms of enforcing our election laws and giving advice to the Secretary of State. We have had an increase in volume, which is a good thing, both inquiries to our hotline and complaints that we've received, and eased in our prosecutions. We've had 6 criminal convictions since January 1st, 2019. We have 6 pending cases. These are very resource-intensive cases, responding to our citizens and investigating election law crimes. Finally, I want to talk about a policy change that relates to the medical examiner's office. And the bottom line here is we need to add positions, but it will be revenue neutral. Why do we need to do this? The United States Internal Revenue Service is telling us we need to. The Office of the Medical Examiner has 20-plus assistant deputy medical examiners. They are currently independent contractors. Their job is to do 2 things. One, when there is an unexpected death, they go out and investigate those deaths and determine whether it warrants further review by the medical examiner's office. Second, they authorize cremation in our state. Both of those are fee-supported services. For the unexpected death investigation, we are reimbursed by our counties for $140. That's set in statute, and the cremation investigation is we're reimbursed $60. The IRS has conducted an audit and determined that independent contractors are not an appropriate way to discharge this function. We have challenged that, frankly, instead of an ongoing dispute with the IRS, we believe this policy change is something that I feel comfortable recommending and will get us out of our dialogue with the IRS. So the bottom line is we would bring in 4 full-time regional ADMEs, assistant deputy medical examiners, and 20 part-time positions. And again, we believe this will be revenue neutral. These are functions supported by the fees we are entitled, we receive by statute from the county and for death investigations and from for cremation. That is my presentation, Governor. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Attorney General. Any questions for Attorney General McDonald?
I would just like to add that, thank you, Mr. Attorney General. During the agency phase of the budget process, given the governor's strong support and encouragement of the LEAC recommendation, members of the committee won't see those as prioritized needs in the submittal, given the statutory authority for the governor to choose what he's to prioritize. So all of that material is available for the legislature, kind of calling out those new programs, but they are, in fact, included in the efficiency budget.
Very good. Any additional questions for folks here? Do we have anyone, Senator Moore, Senator DeLisandro, or Representative Wallner on the line that may want to ask a question of the Attorney General or his staff?
Once again, as a reminder, please
press 5-star. Thank you so much. We'll just give that a minute.
Can I ask a question?
No. Sure.
I just wanted to say that given the one of your prior needs is about an attorney to review mergers and antitrust cases and as the agency that administers the state health plan, I would say that given the enormous threat to health care costs that hospital mergers provide, I want to go on record and say that'd be a great idea.
Oh, appreciate that. That's great.
Any questions?
Okay. Mr. Attorney General, thank you so much. Good to see everybody. Thank you, guys. We're going to take a quick 5-minute break, maybe 3.5-minute break, and then I see Ani is here, and we'll hear from the Human Rights Commission. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hearing's back to order, and we will jump in with the Human Rights Commission. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Ani Malachi, and I am the Executive Director for the New Hampshire Commission for Human Rights. In the last presentation provided by the Attorney General's Office, there is a slide deck that you have. Because the Human Rights Commission is administratively attached, we are in the back of that slide deck. So if you have closed it, just go past the medical examiner's area, and you'll have the handful of pages for the Commission for Human Rights. So I will take you past the main page to the Who We Are page, and just a few pages to encapsulate what the Human Rights Commission does and how we go about our business. The Human Rights Commission was established in 1965 by RSA 354-A, and our purpose is the elimination of discrimination in the state of New Hampshire in the areas of employment, housing, public accommodation, and education, K-12, in public and private was added to our statute in 2019. The commission is comprised of 7 volunteer commissioners who provide oversight and make decisions in charges of discrimination. And these, as I said before, the commissioners are volunteers. They are nominated by the governor and confirmed by the executive council, and they serve a term of 5 years. Move on to the next page. So in a nutshell, what we do is the commission has the power to receive, investigate, and pass upon complaints of illegal discrimination and to engage in research, outreach, education, and community outreach. Yes, there is research with statistics. And we are just outreach designed to prevent discrimination. I'm working on no coffee this morning. I was trying to be a really good girl, obviously failing forward, but we'll work through.
That's dangerous.
Yeah, as you can tell. So in addition to the authority vested in the commission by RSA 354-A, we also have a workshare agreement with the EEOC, which is the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and we also enforce the federal laws against employment discrimination as well. Next page, the commission's organizational chart is pretty self-explanatory. We're a small office. We do a lot with a few, and we're continuing to work on other ways to improve our process and improve efficiencies. And then the next page goes over our numbers. So what we do monthly, we have a monthly commission meeting, and in that meeting we give our commissioners our statistics. So if you look at this page on this chart, you'll see the number of charges that were filed in a particular month, and it goes on to the number of cases closed in that month, the full credit cases. So the difference there is when we voucher with the EEOC and they pay us for the cases that we have closed with them, they do not pay us for state-only cases. And those are driven by certain numbers. The state has a lower threshold for an employer than the federal government does. So if it doesn't reach the federal government threshold, then that is considered a state-only case. We take all cases. We don't turn them away. And whether we're being reimbursed, if you would like to call it that or not, we're taking that case and closing that case for the citizens of New Hampshire. On the last slide there, what we're asking for in our prioritized needs for the state fiscal year 22 and 23 is the reinstatement of funds for the administrative assistant position in our office. So we do have those funds. That position is currently vacant, and we, in our giving blood to the cause, gave that back for this biennium. And we would like to add a position, which would be an informational representative. This person would be dedicated to provide outside training. We do charge for training, so that is a way for the commission to generate some revenue. And this person would focus on creating outreach opportunities, meeting with a variety of citizen groups, work groups, populations, and also could potentially create workshops, and we've done a few of those. It's a little difficult when your full-time job is managing everything and then to be able to create opportunities for workshops. And the reason, the really big reason behind needing this particular position is that, you know, as the AG's office can tell you, you can't always arrest your way or enforce your way out of things, although we are charged with enforcement. However, education is really, really important. There are some businesses here in the state that had no idea who the EEOC was or what they did. So we need to be in a proactive stance to reach these places and provide information and opportunities and making sure that they know that they can reach out to us with questions. Although we don't give legal advice, we can inform them on what the law is and the things that they need to do to basically do right by their employees and to follow the law as it's established in New Hampshire regarding discrimination. The last thing would be reinstating a part-time money. So this was given, already awarded to us, and this was our next pound of flesh that we gave back for this biennium. But it would be great to have that reestablished. The paralegal would assist us, although our process is something that is available to all citizens. If you have a charge of discrimination and you're filing a charge with us, you do not have to have an attorney to represent you. You can represent yourself and move through our process. However, the documents that we create and our process is legal. We do have hearings, and there are motions and other legal documents that need to be provided or, excuse me, created. And having a paralegal, someone with that expertise, can do those in a swift manner, can be very efficient, and it moves it into a more specialized area, which ultimately will help us in terms of time management and efficiency. And that is my presentation, and if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Director Malkai. I have one question, and it relates to potential partnership with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. We've talked about this a number of times, but for federal delegation, do I have that correct, for fair housing?
So if I understand your question, you're asking if regarding HUD, Housing and Urban Development, if we have a partnership with them?
No, I'm sorry. There's we've talked previously about the state taking on additional investigations on the behalf of HUD, and I think we need delegated status or designated status.
It's a sufficiency issue. So the RSA 354A, the way some of it is written as it relates to housing does not match up with how HUD does timelines and some definitions, et cetera. So I have reached out and will be working with the legislature. Hopefully, I've already reached out, so I'm hoping it'll be this cycle. I'm really pushing for that to work on the statutory change that's necessary to make us substantially equivalent. I knew it would come back if I kept talking. To make us substantially equivalent. At that point, we can then move into working towards that work share. I have previously been in contact with HUD, have had a meeting with them. Joe Perlo, who has since changed positions as she's come on as our agency attorney, also met with HUD, and they were very pleased that I had a representative from the Attorney General's office. So they're excited to work with us to get us where we need to be. So we're currently working towards getting that legislation going, and then the rules change will happen once the legislative changes happen. Did that answer your question?
It does. And once we achieve substantial equivalency in the eyes of HUD, that would have a positive revenue impact on the commission.
Absolutely. There are a variety of there are more metrics that you have to meet with HUD than you do with the EEOC. So there are a few more hurdles in terms of the accounting of the cases and how those work and the timing of things. There could be the potential to have I may need to have a dedicated individual. I mean, HUD's preference is to have an attorney So we'll work that out. Maybe that's an MOU with the AG's office. Not sure, we're not there yet. But as we get closer, I'll know. And as it stands right now, HUD cases, once closed, depending on how you close them, they are $3,200 or $3,500 per case closed. And I believe there's some other, like $8,000 or some other number. I can get that specific back to you soon, but if you take it to court, then there's more money. With the EEOC, we receive $800 per closed case.
I just wanted to bring that up for the members of the legislature in the event that a bill becomes before you that does also impact the budget for the commission in a positive fashion. Open it up for other questions. Good morning, Director Malachi.
Good morning.
Nice to meet you. I look forward to working together. One question that you, or a question is something that you said as far as representing yourself for the commission. Is that in the context of a person bringing a complaint forward or an entity defending themselves against the complaint?
So both. So if I have a public accommodation issue with a store, I'm going in, I have an issue. I can file a charge by myself with the commission, and then they will docket that charge and serve that charge of discrimination to the business. If I'm an employee and I have gone through the chain of command and I have an issue, whether it's age-related or disability, et cetera, I can have that charge. I can come to the commission, file that charge against the business, my employer, as well. Some employers are larger and they may have legal representation. Some are smaller and they may not. But both parties can represent themselves as they go through the process. And we're there to answer the questions, to assist them in the process. We don't represent anyone, so we can't give legal advice. And we do provide a roster of attorneys that we know that do work in employment law specifically. But we make it very clear that we're not suggesting you pick attorney A over attorney B.
Thank you. That answers what would have been my second question as well. So thank you. Any questions from the folks on the phone?
If you have a question, please press 5 and star.
Thank you very much, Director.
Okay. Thank you all for your time and your patience, and thank you for your questions.
Well, I know, I'm a little, I do this all day.
It's, people used to say OCD like it was a bad thing, and now we're all broke.
Chairman of the New Hampshire Liquor Commission, and with me is our CFO, Tina Demers. Go green. I can run through that again. I'm Joe Malacca from the New Hampshire Liquor Commission, and with me is our CFO, Tina Demers. We're here to present the agency budget request for fiscal year 2023. Just some quick notes. Tina and I work daily on the finances of the Liquor Commission. We meet every day. We talk every day. So there's nothing more important to the Commission than our statutory responsibility of maximizing revenue for the state. With that being said, our CFO, Tina Vermeer, will walk us through the presentation. Thank you.
Morning. So starting on page 2 of the presentation, we have provided a class category breakdown. Oh, thank you. To compare each year, starting with FY19 and 20 actuals, our FY21 adjusted authorized in the 22-23 budget request. At a high level, our FY21 liquor-funded adjusted authorized is $6.6 million, or 9.4% more than our FY20 actuals. The main factors for the increase are fully funding positions in FY21 versus the vacant positions we had in FY20. And an increase in UIT for infrastructure enhancement for the new POS next-gen system, which we're referencing as the T365 platform. Our FY22 requested budget is $1.2 million, or 1.6% more than the FY21 adjusted authorized. The efficiency budget is decreasing by $268,000, and that's based on maintaining current operations and our core fundamentals. However, there is an additional prioritized need increase of $1.5 million, which is the funding needed for the licensing, cloud-based services, and other support, other software requirements to support the new D365 system. FY23 requested budget is $3.4 million, a 4.3% increase over FY22. And the main reason for the efficiency budget increase is the additional paycheck in going from the 26-day period to the 27th. There are two additional prioritized needs requested in this year, the DOIT software, the same as the prior year, and an increase in contract and operations, which is the maintenance and support contract to take over after the warranty period for the new platform. To go on to page 4, we provided a class level breakdown that shows the greatest changes in the reasons. So the first is, you know, salaries are decreasing in FY22, and this is a result of the change in our positions from people retiring to going to the lower level positions. And FY23 is increasing for the extra paycheck. Benefits are funded based on the current plans and rates. Part-time salaries are based on current trends and staffing needs. Retirees' health insurance is based on an estimate provided by DAS. Our rents and leases are increasing for our current rent obligations and for expanding square footages for new outlet locations. Utilities are decreasing in FY22 and are flat funded in 23 as a result of reduced locations and more energy efficient stores. Our contracts for operations includes our electrical, HVAC, the video surveillance security systems, plumbing, other building repairs. DOIT FY22 efficiency budget is the funding needed to maintain our current POS and back office system. And then the additional prioritized needs is the amount necessary for the licensing and the cloud-based services and other software for the new system. Equipment is based on current spending patterns and our future needs for shelving and checkouts for new locations, and a rotation plan for replacing existing equipment such as vehicles. In-state travel is increasing slightly, and that's to support our store operations needs for moves and staffing changes. And debt service is based on our current bond schedule and estimates for new debt. So on slide 5, we just provided a pie chart that shows the 22 and 23 budget requests and where the money goes. So salaries and benefits are 56%, rents are 12 to 13%, and contracts, DOIT, debt, and current expenses are all around 5 to 7%, which are similar to the prior year. On the next slide, page 6, we have the corresponding annual income statement for FY19 through 23. At the top are sales and discounts, and looking at FY21, which is column B, the D, C, and D, row 1, our FY21 sales growth is remarkably strong at 3% or $23.8 million. It's a result of our current environment with consumers buying more premium products, and our secondary homeowners that are usually more seasonal have been staying in the state. FY22 and 23 projections are less aggressive at 1% and 1.4% respectively, but a current sales level growth is still $8 to $12 million annually. If you continue down to row 5,
FY21 gross profit increases as a result of not running promotional cards, which we had in prior years in July, November, and March, which was the spend $150, get a $25 promo card. FY22 and 23 projections are in line with normal historical growth, and our gross profit percentage is consistently at about 28%. Then on line 9, FY21 net profit increase is abnormally high at $4.9 million or 3.4%. This is due to the gross profit increase. FY22 and 23 projections are flat because of the increase of the initial expenses to support the new D365 platform. Napkins are in base. In line 12, the transfer to the general fund for FY22 and 23 is net of the transfer to the granted advantage based on RSA 176-16, the 5% of the previous year gross profit, which is around $10 million. However, we'd like to note that this fiscal year there is language that allows the additional funds to be transferred to the granted advantage for any projected shortfalls. And at this point, it is currently estimated an additional $8.5 million. So you can see the flow for this in column B starting on row 9. Net liquid profit is projected to be about $146.9 million.
I'm sorry, I'm going to stop you right there.
Sorry.
Just for the additional information of members of the committee, the plan that is put together for the net liquor transfer to the general fund assumes 5% transfer for an advanced plan. The statute allows for an additional transfer to ensure that the program remains solvent.
Correct.
Any funds net of that reduce the transfer from the liquor fund to the general fund, which on our revenue plan would look like the liquor commission is not meeting plans, which they in fact, it does create a kind of a display of information problem. So I appreciate the way you showed everything here today, and if members of the legislature on the phone are here wondering why liquor's revenues aren't doing better when you're looking at the revenue focus, it's due to this transfer.
Correct. Thank you for the
clarification.
Thank you. So, at that, if we were only transferring the 5%, the transfer to the general fund would have been $136.9 million, which would have been $3 million over the plan, but with the additional 8.5, we're looking at the transfer being about $128.4 million, which will be 5.4 less than that plan. On page 8, we've provided a graph on the income statement just to show the net sales, gross profit, expense, and revenue trends. Page 9 is year-to-date revenue as of October 31st versus the prior year. As you can see, plan was $42.2 million. The transfer is actually $46.6 million, so we're up $4.4 million and 10.4%. If you compare this to prior year, total revenue this year is up $18.3 million. Year-to-date transfer to granted advantage is $11.5 million versus the 2.5 that we transferred last year. This is a 350% increase for $9 million. And then we have on slides 10 and 11 our informational items. So would you like to go over these?
Sure. Thank you, Tina. So year to date through November 15th, total sales were over last year 2.9% or $9 million. Our sales in the outlets below in the breakdown of the category retail are up 3.7% or $8.8 million, and that represents 76.9% of our business. Off-premise, our restaurant partners, you can see the massive decline of 19% or $6 million, and they represent 8% of our business. So they are clearly struggling as far as purchases are concerned. There is some bright spots here because off-premise, the grocery chains are up 13.2% or $5.4 million. So people are taking that convenience to heart and purchasing in grocery stores during this time. That's 14.6% of our business. And miscellaneous is accessories in our outlets, which we added on about 7 or 8 years ago. They're up 68.2% or $700,000, it represents 6%, 0.6%. So we're seeing that people are buying
their liquor at the liquor stores and making their cocktails at home and taking advantage of that. We've noticed this week in particular, the last couple of weeks, but this week in particular, off-premises ordering in heavy, so they're looking forward to a busy Thanksgiving holiday period. On the following page, on page 11, just some quick run-throughs of stores that have been opened in the recent years. Tilton, we opened a brand new 12,000 square foot location. We consolidated older locations from Belmont and Franklin. Year-to-date sales are $3 million. They're up just under $500,000, 15.8% increase. West Lebanon, a change from a smaller store, 8,000 to just under 20 in September. Their sales are $7.4 million. They're taking advantage of that cross-border business from Vermont, which we certainly should do. Our increase is 1.5 or 25.3%. And you can see down the list the consolidation in Dover, Summersworth in April of 19. Sales are 5.3. They're up just under $1 million and 20. And just one more, two more that I'd like to go through specifically, a Lancaster relocation, which shows our business in the North Country has increased tremendously due to obviously increased home sales and people staying in their second homes on the lakes and not leaving the state due to the pandemic. 1.2 million increase, around $500,000, 47.9%. And then the Portsmouth Traffic Circle, another location in Colebrook and Rochester. And currently, we've just permanently closed six stores in Whitefield, Newport, Jaffrey, Swansea, store 10 in Manchester, and our airport location, which was obviously decimated by air travel and Delta leaving the airport as well. So there's quite frankly no need to have a store at that location any longer. We have letters of intent for new stores in Claremont, Ringe, and Manchester. And we have steel in the air with three new stores, one in Littleton, one in Epsom, and one in Newport. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Joaquina. Two things. One, steel in the air, that's a new one for me. I like that. The Hampton site. As the statute currently reads, the sale of the Hampton liquor site, the proceeds from that sale would go to retire liquor commission debt.
Right.
Obviously, there's multiple moving factors there, but for members of the commission, could you give a preliminary update on what the projected debt service savings would be in 22 and 23, given the estimated range of sales of those properties?
I'll let Tina go through the debt service piece, but I can tell you that as of today, there will be a realtor under contract for those. We've gone through an RFP, we've selected a realtor, and they'll be with help from DAS and others. And we'll get this done, and these properties will be for sale. We don't currently see them. They may have to be a reappraisal and a few other things, but they should be on the market. We were hoping for some kind of match.
Depending on the timing, since most of our highest amount of debt is paid in December, I don't know how much savings we'll actually see in FY22, depending on the sale of the property, but I do anticipate that we have a savings of about $3 million in FY23.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Representative Wyler.
Thank you. Commissioner, are you going from more rentals to more building your own building?
Well, what we're doing, Representative, is we're working with the landlords that will work with us. We're not owning these buildings per se, but what we're doing is including the fit-up in our rent. So we're doing 20-year rent obligations in these new locations. 10 years will be the base rent plus a fit-up number, which runs around between $2.48 and $2.70 a square foot. And that's put in by the builder and the landlord, and we pay it back over the first 10 years. So usually we see a rent decrease or a stabilization of our rent
after the 10 years. So we have usually a flat fee for the first 10, and then either a drop or a stabilization for the following 10. And it's obviously we don't have to go we don't have to ask for appropriations for funds to build these.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Commissioner Irwin?
What's going on Exit 17?
Exit 17 is we have a letter of intent there, but I think we're kind of waiting for the city to figure out what the, between the city and the landlord, what they're going to do. We've had it there for a while. Obviously, there'll be a market basket at that location as well. And it's sort of like a little volley for serve, it seems, between the city and the landowner as to, and as to who's doing, there's two roundabouts that are necessary, who's going to fund those, how they're going to be paid for. Obviously, we're not taking a position in any additional funding. We're just there to support the area with our services. But hopefully,
eagerly watching,
as am I. I don't live that far from that area. It's needed. Thank you.
Any questions from the folks on the phone? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hearing right on time at 10:45.
No, what's on your mind? It's our outlet.
Our logo.
Oh, okay. My eyesight isn't what it used to be.
It should have been a little bigger.
Right in front.
I'm probably better than coming in with one that looks like a vodka bottle.
Exactly. Like a smile.
We call that good money, Charlie.
Name of the game, right?
call the hearing back to order, and I'll ask everyone to retake their seats so we can jump back in with the Department of Employment Security. Commissioner Arling, I should be recalled.
I have a very important
one. I gather that you live near Exit 17. You have a personal interest in the construction of the store.
It's, I believe, in the economy.
As do I. Do we have the team from Employment Security on the line?
Yes, we do. Can you hear us okay?
Very great. Please introduce yourselves for the record and begin your presentation.
Yeah, George Kapatis, Commissioner of Employment Security, and with me here is Business Administrator Joe Revels, and also on another line is Deputy Commissioner Rich Labors. So the department receives no state general funds, and the majority of its non-matching federal funds comes from the United States Department of Labor. Our biennial budget projection is based on knowledge and expectation of continuation of our core programs, which is employment services, unemployment insurance, and labor market information. The department also receives supplemental funding in the form of a 0.2% diversion of employer state income taxes, and this is under RSA 282A-87, for administrative support in order to cover federal shortfalls, and from which $6 million annually is deposited into the training fund administered in connection with the job training program. The department offers a variety of services to claimants, job seekers, and employers in 12 full-service offices and two itinerant offices located throughout the state. Therefore, personnel services and benefit costs comprise the largest portion of our overall budget. Personnel-related costs comprise approximately 57% of our budget. When unemployment claims increase, as they have from the pandemic, New Hampshire Employment Security receives an additional federal funding based on workloads in excess of our base budget workload counts. A growing economy and low unemployment rate, like New Hampshire was experiencing prior to the pandemic, results in decreased funding for employment security. To put this into context, at the start of the FY 12-13 biennium, the total number of staff at the department was 453, while at the start of the 2021 biennium, the total number of staff was down to 249. Prior to the pandemic, New Hampshire Employment Security had the lowest staffing levels going back 40 years. Considering how quickly the pandemic and related necessary public health restrictions impacted the state's workforce, the department did not have time to hire additional staff in order to meet the growing demand for unemployment benefits and related services. Instead, the department made the decision to address this demand with existing staff and increasing reliance on technology. Employment security staff worked overtime, the equivalent to approximately 95 additional positions in the initial months of the pandemic in order to handle the sudden drastic increase in workloads. New Hampshire Employment Security staff were working longer hours and were working 7 days per week in order to meet the demand. The employees of the department have made an incredible sacrifice during 2020 and continue to make sacrifices and work long hours in order to meet the needs of the citizens of the state. Understanding that such expectations from our workforce is only realistic in the short term, we made the decision this summer to increase staffing levels when workloads were expected to decline. We've been hiring staff these past few months, bringing in additional staff to process claims, to work with customers on the hotline, and to review claims in order to detect fraud prior to benefits being paid. We've hired 22 additional staff in the past 90 days, and 57 positions are in active recruitment, and 17 positions are in the process of being created. We first must post our positions internally in order to give everyone from state government the opportunity to apply. And the positions have been recruiting for a higher labor grade, so we have been attractive for internal candidates from our agency. This then creates, obviously, a domino effect of never-ending interviews. As soon as a position's filled, then another position within the agency opens up, thus starting its own recruitment process. The Department of Information Technology costs approximately 11% of our overall budget. With this budget, New Hampshire Employment Security supports approximately 24 full-time equivalent DOIT positions, 19 that are embedded within Employment Security. The Job Training Fund receives $6 million annually, which represents about 12% of our overall budget. New Hampshire Employment Security relies heavily on technology to administer all of our programs, but most importantly, the unemployment insurance program. Therefore, in addition to Class 27 DOIT, our software equipment and equipment-related maintenance budget represents about 10% of the overall budget. The remaining 10% of our overall budget is comprised of general operating expenditures, such as telecommunications, postage, utilities, supplies, rent, building maintenance contracts. Approximately 3% is designated for training and subsistence payments to eligible participants under the Dislocated Worker, Minor Safety, Senior Community Services, Employment, and Adult Programs. The department submitted a budget of $14,490,810 for FY 2022 and $15,323,820 for FY 2023 in the category of personal services for permanent classified and unclassified positions. This includes 286 classified positions, of which 15 are unfunded this biennium and 7 unclassified positions. The department also included 26 full-time temporary positions in the FY 2022-23 budget request in order to assist with continued elevated workloads for which above-base funding is anticipated. As far as the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund, that is currently at $86 million. This current balance does not include the additional $50 million recently obligated to the trust fund from the state's CARES Act's flex funds. To put this into perspective, the balance was approximately $300 million prior to the pandemic and was declared solvent by USDOL. NHES has paid out $262 million in state UI benefits during the pandemic. As NHES administers both state and federal unemployment programs, we have paid out approximately $1.45 billion in total benefits, the majority of which was federally funded supplemental assistance programs. We've paid out over 165,000 individuals over the past 8 months, and that $1.45 billion is more than we've paid out in the past 10 years when we paid out $878 million. Based upon our current trust fund forecast and the initial $50 million infusion from the CARES Act flex funds, we currently anticipate the trust fund will remain solvent during calendar year 2021. While this is great news for New Hampshire, there are many assumptions involved in this forecast that could shift suddenly because of the pandemic. We need to continue to be very cautious with forecasting the trust fund during these unprecedented times and certainly need to refrain from making long-term predictions without plenty of caveats and proper analysis of all risks. There are currently 21 states borrowing from the U.S. Treasury in order to pay benefits, including Massachusetts and Connecticut here in New England. New Hampshire is not one of them. I look forward to the next biennium continuing to provide essential services to the people and businesses of New Hampshire. With that, that concludes our remarks. We'll take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. I once heard you refer to your department as economic responders, and I can't think of a more apt way to describe the work that you and your team do. It's really been very fundamental to the state's response to the coronavirus pandemic. I only have one question, and this might be for Jill or for Rich. I did notice that you've gone from 2 accounting units, this current biennium, back to the 1 accounting unit that you prefer. And I just want to clarify that this is a move of the job training fund back into the general unemployment security account.
Yes, that is correct. That is moving the job training program accounting unit back under our umbrella accounting unit.
And when I'm looking at what I see, the corresponding revenue source, OOD, federal revolving transfers from other agencies, the $4.1 million approximately in 2022, is that related to the job training fund transfer?
And I'm sorry, can you repeat specifically what line you were looking?
Just when I'm looking at the estimated source of funds for the department, federal revenues transfers from other agencies, 4.8. Is that related to the job training fund, or is that related to another grant?
That would actually pertain to the MOU we have with BEA for the dislocated worker, adult, CSEP, and minor safety programs.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Any questions from members of the committee? Thank you, Commissioner. This is Matt Maywell. I look forward to working together throughout this budget phase. Just a question on potential federal changes in light of COVID-19, and this could be looking long-term. To the extent that there are national standards that are implemented, whether it be on IT or other things of that nature, do you see NHCS as a model that might be a model that's being instituted for other states around the country?
Hey, Matt, this is Rich Lavers. We're a little bit biased here, but certainly we would consider New Hampshire to be a model with what other states and what they've been doing and how they've been responding to the pandemic. I think when the data is released and available, you're going to see that New Hampshire was able to pay a much higher percentage of individuals at a much faster pace. That had a lot to do with the fact that we expanded eligibility through the governor's emergency order before the rest of the country and before the CARES Act was passed. With other headline stories that you've seen throughout this pandemic, one of the number ones has been the amount of fraud that states throughout the country have seen with related to ID theft, related fraud, and the amount of ID theft that's taken part with large data breaches over the last decade. And the numbers that New Hampshire has seen certainly compares similar to other states and what they've seen for the amount of fraud. What differs in New Hampshire compared to other states is the little amount that is actually paid out as a result of fraud. So, we have a great model and a great team in place that has been reviewing claims to make sure that we're protecting those precious trust fund dollars so that they're going out to individuals that are in need here in New Hampshire and not to those bad actors that are offshore that are trying to take advantage of the volume in this pandemic. So I think you're going to see those numbers are going to reflect very well on New Hampshire and what we're doing now with additional money from the feds. With an SBR, a supplemental budget request that was recently funded, we're going to be making additional changes in our computer system to help better detect fraud as we go forward and make it less of a manual-driven process and try to rely more on technology in that regard, as we've been doing throughout this pandemic, really heavily relying upon technology and the expertise of the staff that we do have. So that was kind of a long-winded answer there, but I think, yes, we will be a model for the rest of the country.
Thank you, and I would agree. I would applaud your agency's hard work, especially in the early days of the pandemic, and should the federal government provide additional forms of unemployment assistance in a subsequent bill, I'm sure that your team will stand ready to continue to distribute those funds efficiently and at this point with lessons learned in the early days of the pandemic. Do we have questions from other members of the committee?
Do you have a question?
Thank you very much to the team from Employment Security.
Thank you all.
I would invite the team from the Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Foods to come introduce themselves and begin their presentation.
Good
Oh, I've got to push the button. Sorry. But I think you all heard me. You can impose on line, didn't you? Michelle, you can introduce yourself.
I'm Michelle Thibault, Administrative Assistant Commissioner.
And I apologize for not wearing a tie this morning. I got up this morning and didn't even think about this. I have not been wearing a tie every day at work lately. So don't really have a terribly formal presentation. You have the numbers in front of you. We're a department with 40 full-time authorized positions. Currently, 39 of them are filled. We have several part-time people in FSMA and a couple other places, and we currently have two part-time vacancies within the department. My goal was to keep all of those positions funded through this, and in order to do that, we have drawn down more heavily on one fund, which is the product scale testing fund, drawing down several hundred thousand dollars a year beyond what the income for that is, but that fund currently has approximately $1.5 million in it. So it is sustainable at that level. The reason that that has built up to the degree that it has is that, in fact, we did not have all our positions filled. The revenue had been heavily overestimated in prior years. I don't understand why, but never got called into question, I guess, because we weren't drawing down on the fund. So we balanced that out better. One of the things that we have done is our fleet is in good shape, so we are requesting fewer cars and moving positions in there, and actually moving things around. We had previously had people from weights and measures funded from there. Make a lot of sense to me because all of the money really came in from the Division of Regulatory Services, so we flipped that so that it is actually being used to fund the positions of the people who are bringing in those revenues. The one area that we need is a change of law, which I believe Michelle has copies of that for you, is in the Integrated Pest Management Fund. Currently, that may only be used for the Integrated Pest Management Program, and there is not the demand on that program, and there hasn't been to fully draw that down. We feel a better way to actually use this money rather than building the fund up, which is currently at around $2.4 million approximately, is to actually fund positions within the department, within the Division of Pesticide Control. So the language would be just to say that that fund may be used to fund the Integrated Pest Management Program and the Division of Pesticide Control. Those two things really allow us to meet the governor's target and to adequately fund the department so we can continue to bring in revenue for the state. In the last biennium, I was able to obtain money for the first time in decades for ag land preservation because of the way the budget was late, and then the fact that the pandemic hit, we did not use any of that money. That was $250,000 the first year of the biennium, and $500,000 in the second year. We turned that money all back. So as a prioritized need, I have requested, if things work out, $250,000 per year to restart that program. The very little item, but I just want to make you aware of it. Through our department, we fund the FFA to the tune of $11,000 and the Ag in the Classroom also to the tune of $11,000 a year. Those numbers have not increased in many years, and so I've asked for a very modest $4,000 a year increase for that, which will really help those programs, of course, hopefully get out of the pandemic and get back to normal operations. We do have the list of prioritized needs. I'm glad to go through them, but really I don't want to waste your time with a lot of details you don't want to hear, because there's only so much any of them could absorb.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I have to take this opportunity to really commend you and your team. You did an exceptional job early in the pandemic of both constraining expenses, but then also partnering with the Gopher office, providing relief, critical relief to our agricultural sector.
And we are still working on that. That's been taking up a lot of my time. Printed off some more invoices at this point to pay out before work on it.
As we talked to the for the members of the committee, had lengthy conversations with the Department of Agriculture about shifting more expenses onto dedicated funds, which is always a balancing act. We never want to run dedicated funds dry to put ourselves in a position where going into the next biennium, there aren't resources to sustain our activity. The commissioner's team did an excellent job of really balancing what a fiscally responsible draw on the various funds would be. So we would hope the members of the legislature would review the language that will be in the governor's HB2 to expand the pesticides fund. We again believe is a responsible use of that fund, which has really enabled the department to mitigate some of the otherwise necessary reductions.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Oakley.
Thank you. So the governor has asked somebody to file the bill.
This language will be included in the governor's HB2. It allows for the expansion of usage, for applicable usage of the pesticides fund, which after conversations with our office and the department, we felt was an appropriate usage of the fund, and that budgeting is reflected in what the department submitted as their agency request.
HB2 usually has biennium bonuses language. I understand from what the commissioner said that he wanted this to be a permanent change.
I would like it to be a permanent change because the fund has been growing with no purpose, and that serves no one to do that. So while we're a little out of balance now with the biennium, the hope would be that we'd be able to future bring it so that we could properly balance the fund. But
I want to think about
well understood. Any other questions for the department?
I should see you both outside the building.
Yes, I haven't seen you in there for a while, though.
I'm there.
You're there, you're hiding. Me too.
Come down to my house. I don't know where I was going to see you many times.
It's a long way for me to travel.
Representative Ober saw me last week, and I was on a staging. Maybe I was on the ground.
I hope everything was okay.
Oh, yeah. My vacation was roofing this year.
A noble enterprise. Well, thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did we call them on the phone? If they press 5-star, they could call in.
Oh, I apologize. If anyone on the phone has any questions for the Department of Agriculture. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wait for 5 minutes.
committees to take their seats. Thank you. Do we have the banking department on the line?
Yes, you do, Director Zellum. This is Bank Commissioner Jerry Little. Do you hear me okay?
Hear you great. Thank you, Commissioner Little. Please introduce anyone else on the line with you and jump into your presentation.
Absolutely. My name is Jerry Little. I am State Bank Commissioner on the line. Also, our Deputy Bank Commissioner, Emilia Galdieri, and our Business Administrator, Mike Jeslianowski. Each of you should have received a one-page outline of our brief presentation for today. Assuming you have it, item one talks about the structure of the banking department, and I want to note that there's a slight correction in the very first bullet point. It says the NHBD is organized into two divisions. That should say we are organized into two accounting units. The first accounting unit covers the banking and trust division. That group oversees the activity of all of the state chartered institutions, which includes 16 state chartered banks, 9 credit unions, and a growing number, 36 non-depository trust companies and family trust companies. That's one of the areas where there's significant growth within the industry in New Hampshire. The second accounting unit we have is the Consumer Credit Division. It oversees several thousand licensees. The ones that most people are familiar with are mortgage bankers and brokers and small loan companies. However, we also cover money transmitters, debt adjusters, and the like. The department does all of this with 54 authorized positions, and that number does include 8 vacant but funded positions. We are not seeking any additional positions in our 22-23 budget request. However, we do plan to consolidate or reclassify several of the existing positions, both for some efficiency that we think we can drive, but also to improve services to consumers and businesses, and I'll talk about that in just a minute when we get to section number 4 of your handout. It's important to understand how this department is funded. 100% of our revenues are other sources. We are funded entirely by the private businesses that we regulate. In essence, we go in to do an examination, and after we deliver the report of the examination, we hand over an invoice and charge that entity for the examination we just conducted. We also had to do some enforcement work, primarily on the consumer credit side of things, that can result in fees and fines. We also collect fees for applications that we need to run through and approve. The adjusted authorized expense for both divisions in the current fiscal year is $6.46 million. Our target efficiency target for 2022 is 6.432, so that's a reduction from the current year. Our efficiency target for 2023 is $6.751 million. We met both of those targets, and both of those targets we feel are fair and easy enough for us to work within. The projects that we hope to do within the coming year will not require anything submitted to House Bill 2. First, we want to fill, when the hiring freeze is lifted, a funded but vacant position of IT examiner. Information technology is rapidly gaining in importance in bank regulation. We do not have any a specific IT examiner at this point in time. We have been doing our best to bring all of our examiners up to speed as certified IT examiners, but that's going to take us quite a while, and it's going to be very expensive. And so we've made the decision that we would like to take a couple of our positions, merge them together, and create a specific focused IT examiner that we can assign projects across either of the divisions, either through for the banks, credit unions, and trust companies, or for the consumer credit division. We also would like to create a public information officer position, probably not similar to what you're accustomed to relative to a public information officer. We do have a lot of outreach that we do to schools and community groups for financial literacy and education. Right now we have one of our investigators doing that job. We would like to use our public information officer, one, to go out on the road and bring that education directly to people, but two, and probably more importantly, our website is extremely antiquated. Folks over at DOIT, I believe, call it an electronic filing cabinet. And we know that the governor has had an electronic government initiative for a couple of years. We just have not had personnel to do that for us. So the two primary roles for this public information officer position, which, as I say, is already existing and funded but not filled, will be to do more outreach for consumer protection and education, but primarily to enhance our website so it is less of an electronic filing cabinet and more of a portal or contact consumer-facing type of website where we can do more electronic transmission of information and communication. And then finally, I mentioned earlier that we're seeing a lot of growth within the non-depository trust company section of the department. We have some applications in front of us now to create enormous trust companies, ones that are going to require us to rethink and adjust the manner in which we regulate and examine one, maybe two or more of these very, very large trust companies. And so we would like to sort of redesign and redeploy a couple of positions to allow us to more effectively deal with some of the trust company applications we are getting on the non-depository side of the house to provide effective oversight and consumer protection. And that is pretty much it, unless you have questions for us.
Thank you, Commissioner. I have two quick questions. We have, I'm a big supporter and believer in the efficiency of assessments, but as part of that, we have to ensure we're not putting things in assessments that are inappropriate. And I know you and your team have long been fox-watching to make sure that the banking assessments are fully within the scope of the law. We've talked about in the past the public depository program. You and your department have renegotiated that contract, so the banking department will recoup its costs related to activities that aren't necessarily perfectly tied within its mission. Is that correct?
That is correct. That won't require any legislation or anything in House Bill 2 for us to be able to do that. We have a contract with a group out of Pennsylvania called PFM to administer the New Hampshire Public Deposit Investment Pool. We entered into a new contract with them earlier this year, and in the process of reviewing the contract, we added language that will allow the department to seek reimbursement of its expenses that are spent on its share of administrative work for the public deposit investment pool.
I know it's, it may seem like short dollars, but I think that behooves the state and our obligations to our taxpayers, and in the state, the entity being assessed, that you really only charge them what is within the scope of the law. So thank you and your department for working to straighten that out. And my last question is regarding large-scale trusts. Are you anticipating needing any additional staffing as we've seen it growth in this in the filing before the department to accommodate these increased demands on the department?
We do not anticipate within this 22-23 biennium. The budget as presented will provide us with the resources we need to deal with the applications that we have and have the ability to anticipate at this point in time. But if the trends continue in the way that they have been for the past year or two, year or three, we would probably need to ask for more personnel in the next biennium.
Understood. Thank you very much. Any members of the commission committee have any questions? Open up to the folks on the phone.
Do you have a question?
Good morning, Commissioner Little. This is Matthew Malo. I appreciate your presentation this morning. I just have one question on the PIO position. Could you just talk a little bit more about using this position for the website overhaul as opposed to contracting for those services?
So we had not anticipated contracting them out. We have, as I've mentioned, that the PIO will do a couple of things. So contracting out the website, I feel, would then leave us sort of empty-handed relative to our consumer outreach, which is one thing that's extremely important to us and that I want to reorganize. As I mentioned, right now we have an investigator who takes time from his important work to go out to schools and community groups. Obviously, we're not doing any of that this year, or not since late winter. That's about 50% of the job. So it would not be a full-time web type of position, but we do have updates and changes we need to make on a regular basis. Right now we have a program administrator who manages our website but is not trained in website management. We would like to take both the community outreach and the website management to a more professional level and feel that that one full-time position divided between those two roles is just about perfect.
That makes sense. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and the team for the banking department.
Quick question.
Oh, absolutely.
Commissioner Charlie Arlington, you're well. Question, how bright is the line between your SWAT responsibility and, say, the security division of the Secretary of State? I wonder to what extent financial institutions are becoming are crossing lines now, or is that a fairly bright line?
So I couldn't hear you very well, Commissioner Arlinghouse, but I believe the question is, how is our relationship with the Secretary of State? I assume that's a reference to the Bureau of Securities Registration. Did I get that right, sir? So the relationships we have are excellent. RSA 21U requires the Banking Department, the Bureau of Securities Registration, the Insurance Department, and the Attorney General's Office to gather on a monthly basis and compare notes. Those meetings are happening every month. Our general counsel, Chiara Dolcino, participates on behalf of the banking department. I have gone to those meetings in the past. I haven't in the last year or so, but I have attended them. They are very informative. There is a high level of communication that goes on. I've had questions about some of the trust applications that have come before us as to whether or not we are drifting too deeply into territory in the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Securities Registration. And we simply now have excellent relationships with everybody in all of these departments, and we pick up the phone, we have a conversation, we trade materials, we figure it out. But there's no fear of sharing data or communicating with any of the other agencies that cover justice and consumer protection in financial services these days. I think we have excellent relationships as a result of RSA 21U and observance of its requirements.
Thank you.
Early's mic was off, Lisa, thanks. And with that, thank you, Commissioner. And we'll bring up.
My pleasure. Thank you all very much.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Margaret LeBrec. I'm the Commandant of the New Hampshire Veterans Home. I have a short one page that tells you a little bit about the Veterans Home and currently what our needs and priorities are. I won't read the whole thing, but again, thank you for these opportunities to make a presentation before you. The budget has been built on and reflects our goals, priorities, and needs for the upcoming biennium. This budget was prepared based on 225 census of residents. Currently, unfortunately, due to this pandemic, our census is down to about 135, although we do have 82 active applications. Beginning going into January of this year, we had approximately 180 veterans. We closed our admissions in the month of March due to the pandemic. We opened our admissions back up in June, but unfortunately, as of last week, the New Hampshire Veterans Home was hit with the coronavirus. The admissions have been suspended until such time as public health allows us to then again open back up. I did want you to know we do have 41 applicants who are approved and ready to be admitted to the New Hampshire Veterans Home, although we do take them in. We've been taking them in quite slowly over the last 6 months. Again, when you bring a resident who has dementia onto a unit, you have to isolate them for 14 days, which requires one of my staff to be one-on-one with that resident for that continued period of time because, unfortunately, they don't understand why they need to either stay in their room or to isolate. And as you can imagine, that puts a heavy strain on the staff that we are currently short of. Again, qualified staffing, particularly in nursing, continues to be a huge challenge for the New Hampshire Veterans Home, and that's even with the 20% enhancement approved by Governing Council over the last many years, probably 3 or 4 years. We have been actively recruiting for 38 positions, of which approximately 18 are LNAs. The rest are LPNs and RNs. We've had very little success in recruiting, and I will tell you that is not only in the state of New Hampshire, that's national. Nationwide, there just are not enough RNs, LPNs, or even LNAs today in the workforce. It is a very hard job, and so I can understand why they would rather go and work in the ER or work in a hospital where the people are turning over much faster. When they come to the New Hampshire Veterans Home and work there, you get attached to our residents because you're there 24/7 with them and they're like family. So when they pass away, of course, my staff are bereaved just like family. So again, it's a very hard job to do, but again, it's very rewarding. And so that is what we try to push in order to get staff in our positions. VA regulations do mandate that we have a qualified staff with certain ratios in order to provide and promote their physical, mental, and psychological well-being when we provide high skills, the best quality of care, and quality of life to our veterans. One of the huge challenges you can read there, of course, women's health care, bariatric care, hospice care, dementia with behavioral disturbances, as well as specialized care that our Vietnam veterans need at this time. We currently have approximately 49 Vietnam veterans who live with us today. Our youngest veteran is 62 years old, and our oldest veteran general is 102. So, again, we have quite the swath of needs and specialized needs in our veterans. I do want to highlight bariatric care. When the building was built, it was not built to be able to allow for the larger beds to be able to go in and out of the thresholds of the doorways. So we have certain rooms that we just can't physically fit the bariatric beds, bariatric wheelchairs, the overhead lifts that are required. We have purchased a new tub, actually, that would allow for a wider seat. But again, we're really running into some of those problems. So we're currently, we've asked for a master plan so we could actually look at the thresholds and the doorways and to try to figure out what would be the best area that we could be renovated so that that population could be admitted Currently, we are holding our admissions very low on anyone who weighs in excess of 350 pounds due to the fact that we just can't physically care for them. And we don't have areas that we can safely have them in cared for. And again, we're always looking for new and replacement equipment, beds, overhead lifts required for the greater needs of our residents. We're very excited that we have an electronic medical record that's fully operational, and so that going forward, during this pandemic, our survey, which is done by the VA, they have not come in yet this year due to the pandemic, so they're looking at possibly doing it remotely and only have those staff members from our Manchester VA would come up and do the things in-house that they needed to, and that would protect our residents from people flying from outside the state of New Hampshire. With that point-click care system, we are able to give them remote access, and so they would be able to review all records and be able to do their complete VA survey virtually. Again, I thank you for allowing me to come and talk to you today. I'm happy to go over any of the numbers that we've put forward, but I don't want to belabor what you may or may not have.
Thank you very much, Commandant. Thank you to you and your team. I know this is probably, it has to be the most difficult situation your staff has gone through in their career, so thank you. Pilot service provider, your residents and our veterans. Your budget was based on a census assumption.
225 residents.
Obviously, you have set fixed costs and there's variable costs. I think as we learn more, as the budget goes through both the governor's phase and the legislative phase, I think I just want to make sure that in the event that census changes impact the budget either up or down, we're not using static numbers. So I would ask that you provide both the governor's office and then when the budget comes to the legislature, update depending on the census. Do you anticipate movements either up or down based on the census, or are our fixed costs really a significant portion of the budget, so the variabilities in the census are less swingy?
There will be a huge variable, you know, because right now a lot of the cost is based on the resident census. I do still need to have staff in order to care for those, and unfortunately the staff numbers have been low, but they've been augmented with overtime, which is time and a half, and the traveler's contract that we put in last year. And that traveler's contract, we were able to get four individuals in to help two RNs and two LNAs. But again, those costs are much higher than having a staff member in. So again, that is why in the House Bill 2, I believe we've asked, or in the footnote, for flexibility in that, so that if we're able to bring full-time staff in to fill those positions, we can do that. Or if we need to have it in the traveler's line, which is what we put in 5359, and you know what that exact line is. Page 3205 under professional care. If you look at line 101, medical payments to providers, as you can see, last year we only paid out $242,000 change. We had put aside a little over $1.6 million for providers. So therefore, in the efficiency budget, we realized that although our hopes were that they were going to be able to help us with staffing, in reality, they were only able to provide us with a certain number. So therefore, we brought that number back down in hopes that we were able to find staffing. But again, that's my staffing level today. I can go up to approximately 180. If I'm able to actually get up closer to the 225, I would have to, again, fill positions that are funded. But if those positions are not funded, that would last. And again, the huge bulk of our budget is staff and benefits. I think it's like 94% of our overall budget is tied up in those lines. But again, I'll keep you informed as our census goes forward and our ability to staff.
Thank you very much. Questions from members of the committee?
Peggy, how long have you been in the Veterans Home?
I've been in the Veterans Home since
25, have been the commandant since 2013.
Which is impressive given the challenges you face. And I'm
Thank
very, it's a very good thing for the state that you're there.
Appreciate that.
Nursing is the biggest challenge, or basically all direct care?
All direct care at this time. In our LNAs, it's those that do the bulk of the hands-on care to our veterans, although we're mandated to have the RN at the home every single day, every single shift. So even if it's only one, which we don't feel that that's the quality of care if you only have one RN. So we've even instituted our LNAs to now step up if they do more competencies to become an LMNA, which is a medical nursing assistant, and then they're able to actually help pass the medications onto the floors as long as they have oversight of an RN or an LPN. So we are really trying to look at all different sides, but of those 38 positions, again, most of the majority of LNAs on the second and third shifts, which are the most undesirable shifts, as you can imagine, and RNs, I think the RNs were, we need six RNs. So I was very pleased last year to hear that the governor had put additional money to try to help more nurses go into UNH, Plymouth, and Keene. I don't know when we'll see any fruition from that.
You, as a general principle, you're seeing, I mean, we hear obviously every, you know, after hospital and Clinton and everything else, everything you can think of, there are huge staffing crises in healthcare. Is it, are you just part of that? Or, I mean, I understand that, you know, because of the long term care aspect of that and the getting attached to your residents, which is a great thing, but
yeah,
it's very difficult. Is there a long-term solution, and is it, I mean, the additional nursing education maybe helps, but is there another long-term solution, or is it just going to be a continual problem?
I think the only way that this can be solved is to get kids when they're still in high school, right? You're talking to kids in high school, showing them a love for the medical field, maybe, or the elderly population. We just currently are putting together our own LNA program so that there's not that cost up front for our individuals or our staff before that 8-week program. We're looking at being able for them to do their clinical right on site at our home, so they're getting paid to take the job and to do the work. We're soliciting from our dietary department, which does not make my dietary manager very happy, but it's effective because they've already become attached to our veterans. So you get the attachment and the loyalty, whether it's a housekeeper, a laundry person, or a dietary staff. Those are the best ones that we can get to roll into an LNA program, and we find that they last the longest and that they're able to provide the services that we need. And then, so we call our dietary department the filler department. Our feeder department, thank you.
The University of New Hampshire is in the process of physically building out the space to enable them to expand their nursing program. There were delays due to COVID, but it's our hope with the next year's incoming nursing class at the University of New Hampshire will be larger. And the community college has had successful expansion of their LPN program. So if there's anything the state can do to further the partnerships between our institutions of public higher education and our state direct care facilities, please comment on, make sure we know. I mean, sometimes
we do reach out to UNH, Plymouth, and have interns come to the home and do their clinicals. So we have a great relationship with them, so we want to bolster that, especially with the technical institutions, because an LPN program can push out a nurse or an LPN in a year or 2 years, and it's just different duties that they can do with RN oversight.
But again, if there's anything, sometimes it's statutory regulatory changes, and sometimes it's just making the connections and the partnerships. So if there's anything the state can better do to make sure our component units are coordinated, the governor's office is always happy to jump in.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any additional questions?
Do you have a question? Please turn to our administrator.
Thank you very much, Governor.
Again, thank you for your time. Please wear your mask, socially distance, and wash your hands every chance you get. Thank you.
We will take a 13-minute break until 12 o'clock when we will start with the fees development.
So,
Beck,
I'm
Thank you, everyone. We're going to jump back in it with the Division of Ports and Harbors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gino Marconi. I am the Director of the Division of Ports and Harbors, East Development Authority. Just for a little bit of background on this, but again, for the record, the New Hampshire Port Authority was established by the legislature in 1957. It was a standalone state agency until 2001, when we were merged administratively with Peace Development Authority. I say administratively because under federal FAA regulations, all revenues and money generated by the Peace Development Authority can only be used by Peace. So we are self-funding as a subdivision of Peace. We generate our own revenue stream. But Peace provides resources to us that allow us to operate more efficiently as a maritime and marine organization. That being access to the executive department, both the legal department, especially the finance department, and the engineering department. And we do reimburse PEs for the services that they provide to us. So that would segue into the discussion of what you have for you with our budget. The enabling legislation that merged us with PEs mandated that the existing classified employees of the Port Authority would remain classified employees. So we have six full-time classified employees, and that's what you see in the document before you. I should say six classified positions, because there are only five of them that are filled at this time. The sixth position is the operations manager, and when that operations manager retired, we filled that position and we classified them as a P's employee. So that sixth position has not been filled. We don't tend to. Through attrition, our plan is that as the other classified employees retire, we will fill those positions with the P's positions on the P's books as an employee. Two of those positions, the chief and the deputy chief harbor master, are required by statute to be certified by the police standards and training council. They have law enforcement officers, and they have the authority to enforce the law, criminal code on division properties. The other positions are administrative. We've got three people that are administrative in harbor management, handling the mooring permits, an administrative assistant to keep me out of trouble on a day-to-day basis, and secretary one position that works down at Rye Harbor. So that's what you see in front of you is the cost of those employees. However, I need to emphasize that we reimburse general fund for that expenditure. Because they're classified employees, we submit the payroll to the state. They are paid out of the treasury, and then we reimburse the general fund for that expenditure for those employees. So that's my story, as simple as it is.
Thank you, Captain Marconi. Obviously, the division does incredibly important work. We do have the smallest coastline of any state with a coastline, but it's our maritime state, and it's been steeped in our state's history. Can you quickly just run through to members of the committee some of the facilities the division manages?
We've got a pretty diverse statutory charge. I'll start at the simple ones first and work up to the facilities. We are the grantee in the state of New Hampshire from the U.S. Department of Commerce Foreign Trade Zone Board to establish and maintain foreign trade zones projects in the state of New Hampshire. Foreign trade zones are areas designated by the board and under the supervision of U.S. Customs for the purpose of assessing the collection of customs duties. Merchandise in the zone is considered not to be in the commerce of the United States, so duties are not payable at that time. One of our big users is a company over in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, Millport Corporation. Their last annual report, they indicated they employed 935 people, and I'm reading the newspapers, talking to them, they're looking to do an expansion over there, an increase in that. We also manage a revolving loan fund, which was a grant from Economic Development Administration. That goes back to 1995, it was an $810,000 grant. Today, we've issued 111 long-term low interest loans to those commercial fishermen, and has a value of, I think, $3.4 million. I could be off on that number a little bit. It's been very successful. We've only had two defaults in the history of it early on. There was a $30,000 default, and recently there was a loan. The guy was paying $100 a month because he was conscientious about and the revolving loan fund committee wrote off the remaining $1,000 is a bad debt, but the guy was in a tough spot. Been very successful, good for the commercial fishing industry. We're responsible for the placement and permitting of the moorings and tidal waters of the state. We have up to 1,500 mooring locations located in the tidal waters. We're also responsible for the maritime security and operation and management of some physical facilities. One mixed-use facility, Hampton Harbor, which is recreational boating, commercial fishing, whale watch boats, and charter fishing boats, and party boats. Same thing with Rye Harbor, it's a mixed-use commercial and recreational and passenger vessels. We have responsibility for the commercial fish pier in Portsmouth, and it's strictly commercial fishing operations there, done by Prescott Park. And then the most prominent asset that we've managed is the Market Street Marine Terminal in Portsmouth. It is the only state-owned deep-water general cargo facility located in the state. And when I say it's the only general cargo facility, all of the other terminals located in Portsmouth Harbor and the Scatterwater River are cargo-specific. For example, when Irving or when Sprague Energy built their terminal, they were only interested in hooking up the hoses to the manifold pumping oil. We have the ability to handle diverse cargo. We've done windmill blades and components for the windmill project up above Berlin. Recently, we did towers and other components for the windmill project over Antrim. Right now, we're in the middle of a big project with the Navy on the super flood basin. The contractor that has the contract do this is all in water work, and all of the components and materials and equipment for that project has gone to our facility. The Navy is about to go out to bid on the next phase of that super flood basin project, which is estimated between $500 to $700 million project. So that's one of the things we do at that facility is we support all of the other businesses and facilities along Riverman Harbor. Sprague is doing work on their facility. The contract is coming all across our dock. So it's a general cargo, multiple use, and it's public access because it's not private. That's the Cliff Notes version of it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Captain Marconi. Any questions for members of the committee? Anyone on the phone?
Do you have a question for the Department?
I would just say, in terms of positions, I noticed you have an administrative assistant who's in charge of keeping you out of trouble. I would just say that it seems to me that you would probably want to expand that portfolio to more than one person.
If I may ask the chairman, I have a very qualified administrative assistant at home keeps me out of trouble.
Well put.
Well, members of the committee, thank you for indulging me as I talk about this. I'm those of you that know me over the years, I'm very passionate about sport and what we do there. But I have to just one parting comment is it's not me, it's the people that work there. They're involved in it, they're committed to it. We've got some young people that are coming in that are really taking the helm at the facility. So the future is right now. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Dino.
Dino, how many years now?
That's embarrassing. Don't ask me.
Well, it's interesting, Representative Weil, that the reason I ended up there was the last ship I was on, I left the shipyard in November, and I didn't get back home until May, and the port was looking for somebody to go in and an outside contractor to go in and set up the revolving loan for the fishing industry, and I said, gives me an opportunity for me to sleep in my own bed for a change. While I was there, they created the operations manager, and they asked me to stay on and help, you know, get that set up and get that position going. And then there was some changes in the administration, and at the time, Governor Shaheen asked me to fill in as the acting director for a while, and never left. So I was appointed full-time director July 1st of 2002.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Where did the years go?
I really, really like what I do. I enjoy the people. I've met some great people here, and I like it.
Well, we're lucky to have you. We are going to adjourn, and we will return at 1:15 with the Department of Environmental Services. Thank you, everyone.